True Crime Brewery contains disturbing content related to real-life crimes. Medical information is opinion based on facts of a crime and should not be interpreted as medical advice or treatment. Listener discretion is advised.
Welcome to True Crime Brewery. I'm Jill.
And I'm Dick.
I hope you enjoy our new original music written for True Crime Brewery by talented musician Tristan Capel.
I like it.
It's very nice. I like it too. I hope it'll grow on everybody.
I'm sure it will. This episode is brought to you by Outdoor Voices. For 20% off your first order of $100 or more, visit outdoorvoices.com/TCB and enter TCB.
Support for this podcast is also brought to you by Hanover Square Press, publisher of The Boy at the Keyhole by Stephen Giles. A haunting tale of confusion and paranoia, this story is about a boy left alone on his family's English estate with a housekeeper he suspects has murdered his own mother. Listen to the audiobook today. Back in 1999, a homeowner in New York removed an old 55-gallon barrel from his basement. The trash men wouldn't take it because it was too heavy. So he opened it. The smell was horrific. A woman's shoe bobbed to the surface. Locked away in that barrel for over 30 years was the now mummified body of a young woman and her full-term fetus. She was fully clothed with her purse and address book inside. Police would take hours extracting these remains from the barrel. The odor was so offensive that gas masks were worn by every person in the vicinity. Investigators in this case did incredible work examining the contents of the barrel, going over the lineage of ownership of the house, and putting together a tragic series of events that led to the violent death and decades-long disposal of a young immigrant woman who put her trust in the wrong man. In today's discussion, a disposable woman, we're talking about one of the most remarkable cold cases ever solved. What may have been a simple story of an extramarital affair and an unwanted pregnancy became an obscene affront to humanity, a case of a person being cast aside and discarded as if she were nothing. So I'm looking forward to this discussion today, and what are we going to be drinking?
We're going to be drinking a beer called Chocolate by Southern Tier Brewing Company in Lakewood, New York, one of my stouts. But this one is a little bit different. This is something I would call a dessert beer.
Oh, that sounds pretty good, actually.
To me, it's a beer that you would obviously have with a dessert and not as the main focus of your beer drinking.
Okay.
So it's an accompaniment.
That sounds nice.
So Chocolate is one of these. It's a black beer. It has a small kind of orangey tan head that fades pretty quickly. The aroma is all sweet chocolate, a little bit of roasty stuff, and some vanilla. And the taste is kind of a milk chocolate and espresso taste. Pretty pleasant. It's a sweet beer, and it does have 10% alcohol, so it's kind of warming as you drink it. But it's a good beer to have with dessert.
Okay.
Just because of the sweetness.
All right, so good with a piece of chocolate cake, maybe?
Sure.
That's what I'm picturing.
Or I would have it. You know how much I like pecan pie.
Yeah.
So chocolate pecan pie and a little bit of this stout.
That does sound yummy.
It would work well.
All right. Well, let's open it up and then maybe we can scrounge up some dessert to have with it.
Okay. Although it also gave me an idea for Thanksgiving when we have dessert. We'll have a pecan pie and chocolate.
Okay. Have you got enough bottles?
No, I'll need some.
All right. We'll go out and get some more.
Okay.
All right. Let's open it up. Okay, here we are at the quiet end, and why don't you start out our discussion today, Dick?
Okay, so this goes back almost 20 years. On September 2nd, 1999, homeowner Ronald Cohen had sold his house, and he was cleaning out the basement as requested by the new owners of the house. Ronald had been in this house for about 10 years, and it was time to move on. So in the basement, there was a 55-gallon barrel that had been in that basement under the back porch ever since he and his wife, or he and his family, moved in, like I said, 10 years earlier. And they'd never touched it. So that's an interesting thing to me anyway. You move into this house and there's a barrel in the crawl space.
Yeah.
And you just leave it. You don't say, I wonder what that is, or...
Yeah, he isn't the only one that did that, though.
I know.
And he said that his kids would go into that crawl space area and play hide and seek, and they just never thought much of it.
Yeah, no, in fact, Ronald thought that the old container, kind of rusty-looking thing, just held building materials from when the porch above it had been built.
Yeah.
So the movers helped Ronald move the barrel, which was pretty heavy, and they rolled it out to the street for trash day pickup. Now, the next morning, the trash truck came, but they didn't take the barrel because of its weight. The trash people left a note in Ronald's mailbox saying he either needed to open the barrel and lighten it or dispose of it in another way. They would only take it if it weighed less than 300 pounds and if it was not sealed.
Yeah, so it wasn't just the weight. I think it was also the fact that they didn't know what was in it.
Well, yeah.
You can't just put a sealed barrel out there, right?
Right?
Yes.
Might be some kind of hazardous waste or something in there.
Yes, so they wanted it opened and lightened.
Right.
So this is what he was going to do because the new owners wanted all that stuff cleared out, which I don't blame them. I'm surprised the owners before didn't ask for it to be moved.
Yeah. Why didn't Ronald ask for it to be removed?
I don't know.
Wouldn't have been his problem then.
I know, right? So Ronald enlisted the help of a neighbor and they cracked open the seal on the barrel with a screwdriver. The smell that came from the barrel as soon as the seal was broken, though, was just horrid, so horrid that both men were gagging. And a woman's shoe sprung up from the liquid in the barrel. It was an upside-down woman's red shoe, and on closer inspection, it looked like it was still on a human foot. Floating next to the foot was a human hand wearing a ring.
Yeah, I can't even begin to imagine how grisly and horrific a discovery that was.
Be like a nightmare or a horror movie.
Yeah. You open this thing up, you're knocked over by a stench, and there's a shoe and a hand floating, or not, maybe not floating, but over above the surface of the liquid.
Yeah, it's just horrible. I know. They were quite shocked.
I can imagine. I think one or both of them actually vomited, didn't they?
I think one of them did. I know they were gagging, and I know that Ron's wife wasn't very happy when she heard about it either.
Can you imagine?
She'd been living with that thing for years.
It just really creeps you out.
It does.
So police responded quickly to the 911 call. In just a few minutes, they were everywhere. And the smell from the barrel had intensified outside. So about 10 squad cars were lined up on the block. A few neighbors had come out of their houses, and they were all pretty curious about what was going on. But police kept them away from the house. They hung yellow police tape across the street, tying it to trees, and three police officers guarded the barrel. No one went near it. No one touched it. But you sure could smell it.
The whole neighborhood, yeah. Inside the barrel, investigators could see the shoe and a hand with leathery skin. They weren't sure if the barrel held an entire human body at this point or just an arm and a foot. Ronald was interviewed about his knowledge of the barrel, of course, because he's the one that's been living with it for years. And he was, of course, a suspect in the beginning. And he said, well, he really hadn't thought much about it over the years. It was just something that was down there, and it never got in the way. And like you said, he just thought it was leftover stuff from the project.
Yeah.
Yeah. So police did call his wife, and she backed up Ronald's story. She was quite shocked, of course, and she refused to stay in the house even one more night, even though they were moving in like 2 days. So they went and spent the night in a hotel. Now, I don't know. The body's out. I think I'd stay there. It's the nights before you were sleeping with a body in the house.
True, but they didn't know it.
No.
Yeah, so now that you know what was in the barrel for all those years, yeah, I'd say I'm done with this house.
Well, there was a lot of superstition kicking in there, I guess. Because after that, Ronald would say that, oh, he remembered this and that. They had a nanny who said the house was haunted, things like that. So a lot of superstition started kicking in once they knew about it.
Yeah, that's the key element, once they knew about it.
Exactly, right.
It all came together.
Yeah. So they didn't want to stay there anymore. Ronald took investigators into the crawl space where the barrel had been for all those years, And the container had left a ring of kind of rusty dirt on the cement.
Yeah, so it had been sitting there untouched, unmoved.
Yes. Yep. For over 10 years at least, they'll find out it was even longer. So like I said, it weighed about 300 pounds, over 300 pounds, and emergency workers were able to move it with an electronic lift, and they transported it to the medical examiner's office. There, the barrel was placed over a large white sheet as it was carefully tipped onto its side. A green fluid drained out of the barrel, and a sample was taken for analysis. Now, body fluids are not green.
No, they aren't.
No. So it would turn out that the green fluid was actually some kind of plastics dye.
That was in the drum.
Yes.
Yeah.
And the body inside the barrel was actually mummified and intact. It was surrounded with black and white plastic pellets. So some of the pellets were sent to the lab to determine what they were and where they came from, because that could be a big clue. So tell us a little bit about the condition of the body, because it's quite remarkable.
So the skin, I mean, this was basically an intact body.
Yes.
The skin had been turned into leather. There were no organs remaining once they cut her open.
Yeah, it was pretty much just bones and skin.
And one surprise, which we'll talk about. And the body was a small young woman with dark hair. The clothes were stained dark from body fluids. But the uncovered parts, the head, face, hands, and wrists, appeared to be extremely well preserved. The fingers had shriveled, but the little ring still fit them. The natural wrinkles on her knuckles were still there. She had an intact nose, a slightly open mouth, and a set of front teeth with gold bridge work. A locket, couldn't make out the metal because it was stained, hung around her neck. Her eyes, which had no color at this point because of the length of time she'd been in the barrel, were still framed by eyelashes and eyebrows.
So she still has hair. And what is it in the eye that makes them have their color that would be gone?
Well, it's just you have pigment in your iris.
Right.
That does it. And if you're underwater for a length of time and you're not living, obviously, the color will fade.
Okay, but she wasn't really underwater.
Well, she was in a liquid.
There was some liquid and some plastic.
Yeah. Right.
But it's amazing to me that her eyelashes, her eyebrows, her hair was still there, which makes it all the more macabre.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, she was mummified.
Yeah. And what does that really mean, mummified?
Well, it doesn't mean like we think about from horror movies.
No.
With the mummy walking around and terrorizing people.
Oh, no.
It looks like they're all wrapped up and stuff.
Yeah, so she wasn't wrapped in anything, but she was mummified.
She was mummified. And the way you mummify is if you're in a container where you're in an area where there's dryness and no humidity and no oxygen, you'll mummify. So in ancient Egypt, they did this by burying them in the sand, nice hot sand, that quickly desiccated, dried out the body, and that was it. You could be more elaborate, and the Egyptians had a whole way of mummifying people. Of course, you had to be in the wealthy class to do this. Couldn't just be anybody to do that. So there were different steps that the ancient Egyptians used, which aren't exactly the way we'll look at this case, but there are some similarities.
Okay, let's hear them. I just find that very interesting.
So the first thing to do in ancient Egypt was to purify the body. So the body was washed with wine and spices by professional funeral people. Then it was rinsed with water from the Nile. Then after the body had been washed, any parts of the body that could decay were removed. So the brain was taken out, the lungs, liver, stomach, and intestines were taken out. The heart wasn't, because it was believed to be the center of intelligence and feeling, and the dead would need that in the afterlife.
But they wouldn't need their brain.
Nope.
Because we didn't know anything about the brain back then, I guess.
Back in ancient Egypt.
Okay.
Then the body was stuffed with bundles of a natural salt and covered the body. And then it was placed on a slanted couch so that any fluids that dripped as the body was drying could be collected and buried along with it. Then while the body was drying, the removed internal organs were washed and packed in the salt. Then they were wrapped in linen. And then after 40 days, the body at this point was all dehydrated and shrunken. Then it was embalmed and made ready so they'd make the body look as lifelike as possible. And then it could be buried in the pyramid or the tomb or whatever.
Right. But those weren't airtight, were they? Were they completely airtight?
Yeah.
Oh, they were. So similar situation to the barrel.
And that's that. Well, that's where the similarity comes from. Because, yeah. I mean, if you're in an environment where there's flow of air, you're not going to mummify.
Well, no. If her body had been out in the woods for 10, 20, 30 years.
It would decompose.
It would just be bones.
Right. From decomposition and from animals and insects and everything doing their work on the body.
Right.
But if you're in a closed environment with no oxygen, things will dry up, even in a place that had some liquid and whatever material was in there.
Yeah.
Because besides the bodily fluids, you could mummify without decomposition because it's oxygen free, airtight.
So even though you say it's like a mummy, not from a horror movie, it is kind of like a horror movie if you see the footage of when they're extracting the body from the barrel.
Oh.
It does look like a horror movie.
Yeah.
Because her whole body's there.
Her whole body's there. And maybe not exactly unrecognizable, but really looked bad.
Well, yeah. Yeah, that's an understatement. Looked terrible. So what else about her? Her clothing.
Yeah, now her clothing seemed dated. She wore a 1960s style dress and shoes. She had some jewelry on, one of which was a locket inscribed to Patrice, love Uncle Phil. She had long dark hair, which was still in place except in the areas where she had sustained multiple blows to the head. So here's another clue. She had apparently died from blunt force trauma to her head, and she had been hit many, many times. So police investigating it thought this was the type of killing where there had been a lot of rage directed towards the victim. So totally beat up.
Mm-hmm.
So after the woman's face was inspected, there was an important clue found by investigators. Some of her teeth had been outlined with gold inlay. Now, this was not something normally done in the U.S., and this led detectives to believe she could have been an immigrant.
Well, when the autopsy was done, the small bones of a fetus were found within this body, and it was determined that she'd been carrying a full-term male, 17 inches long. This gave detectives a likely motive. Maybe the killer was the father of the baby. Now, to me, it's disturbing that that's where detectives are going to go immediately. When a pregnant woman dies, they're going to say maybe it was the father of the baby. You know, a guy who didn't want anything to do with the pregnancy or was abusive to her. And as we know, unfortunately, homicide is one of the leading causes of death for pregnant women in the U.S. We have many recent examples. We have Lacey Peterson, who disappeared on Christmas Eve 2002. Of course, her husband, Scott, was convicted of her murder. In 2013, Kelsey Schelling was a young woman who was lured to see her boyfriend and the father of her baby when she was pregnant, and she was never seen again. In 2014, another case we covered was Erin Corwin, who was a pregnant young woman, and she was having an affair with a guy named Christopher Lee, who killed her and the baby. This episode, I think, was called Lured. Then we have, just very recently, Laura Wallen in 2017, who was pregnant and killed by her boyfriend, the baby's father. And then very recently, just last month, Shanann Watts, 34, and her daughters, Bella, who was 3, Celeste, who was 4, and the unborn son that Shanann was carrying, were killed by her husband and the father of the baby and the father of Bella and Celeste, Chris Watts. So if you look up in recent crimes, there's actually case after case of men killing pregnant women who are carrying their child. And these are just the well-known ones. It seems to happen all the time.
Well, maybe not all the time.
Several a year, at least.
I do have a Center for Disease Control study of female homicide victims.
Okay.
It was published in 2016. And this was looking at over 10,000 homicides from 2003 to 2014. Over half of them were intimate partner violence. So the father, usually, or husband, occasionally another woman. but most of them are male. And of these numbers, 15% of these ladies were either pregnant or had recently given birth. So a couple things about that. And then what they're trying to look at is trying to see if there's a pattern seen in non-lethal domestic violence that could be a predictor for lethal intimate partner violence.
Well, that just seems like something that we already know. Don't we already know that?
I think so. I think we already know what sorts of things you're looking for that might predict further violence, right?
I would think so. But what about the pregnancy? I mean, what does that bring to it?
Well, pregnancy adds a lot of stress, right? Not just for the mother who's carrying the pregnancy, but for the father of the child. And in this case, this was a married man having an affair.
Right.
So there's a lot of stress with that.
I would guess so.
But yeah, I don't know exactly. Other than saying that there's added stress with a pregnancy, I don't know what other things would be in play.
I don't know. I think there's a psychology behind it. But I would guess it would be different. The man who's having an affair and kills his pregnant wife is a very different thing from the man who's having an affair and kills his pregnant mistress. Or is it the same thing?
Probably the same thing. The pregnancy.
I guess, but I just feel like with the mistress, this is a person that's in the way. Although, I guess it's the same thing with the wife. The wife's in the way of the life he thinks he's going to have with this other woman.
Yes.
Yeah. So, I guess some men choose to kill rather than take responsibility for their unborn child. And usually there definitely is a history of domestic violence. But of course, family and friends don't always know about this. And this is the case here with this woman is we don't know if there was domestic violence with the man who killed her prior to her death. But I think it wouldn't be surprising if there was.
No, it wouldn't. Just turning that CDC study around, there's often, when there's a death of a woman, a pregnant woman, usually there's hints that violence had occurred prior to the death. And there's an idea that, well, something's going on here.
But in a relationship where the man is abusing the woman and then the woman becomes pregnant, often the abuse becomes worse. And you're saying that that's because of stress.
Right. Probably other things too.
Other things. I mean, we've read about men who are actually jealous of the pregnancy or the new baby.
Sure,
that seems to be an issue with a lot of people.
Less attention for them.
Right. When we actually did a case on, was it in Scotland or Ireland where the guy was killing his babies? It's kind of a Munchausen case, but we weren't sure. But it turned out that he was jealous of his wife giving attention to the babies.
Yeah, that was overseas.
Yeah, it was either Ireland or Scotland.
Yeah,
yeah.
British Isles.
Yep. Okay, well, there were multiple clues inside the barrel after the body had been removed, too. One was a green plastic stem and leaves that was about 6 inches long. So this looked like part of a plastic plant or a flower arrangement. And they weren't sure at first if this was significant or if this was just some random piece of trash that ended up in the barrel. But we'll find out it was significant. Also in the bottom of the barrel, police remarkably found a purse with makeup and an address book. Now the address book could be a big thing, but it was tiny. It was only 2 inches by 2 inches. And it had been saturated completely by her bodily fluids. But the document recovery department had this drying oven that they would use to try and salvage this book and possibly find some phone numbers. So this is remarkable.
It is. And they were lucky. Maybe not lucky. Skillful. Both. But they were able to find evidence in the address book.
Which is crazy because when they first described pulling it out, it was so saturated your finger would just go through it like mush.
You would think that there was no way they'd get anything from that.
Yeah, it would have to be a meticulous drying process because they had to dry it to a certain point where they could get the pages separated.
Right.
And then they had to dry the individual pages.
And then dry each page.
And let's remember, it's a 2-inch page.
Right.
So it's amazing. So before we get further into the case, why don't we take a little break here to talk about our sponsors?
So first up is Outdoor Voices. They are making high-quality active apparel to take you from the gym life to everyday life seamlessly and effortlessly. So not only is this clothing comfortable for everything from playing with the kids to running a 5K, Outdoor Voices has a really neat philosophy encouraging living happier, healthier, more sustainable lives through daily exercise of any kind.
And they do have clothing for both men and women. Dick got some really nice dark blue shorts and a t-shirt, which he loves to wear when he's walking the dogs or working around the house or if we go for a hike. And I really love Outdoor Voices sports bras and leggings. They have the leggings that are just capri length, which are great for hiking in the summertime when it's so hot out. They fit great, and they're definitely made to sweat in. I really do have a hard time finding activewear that doesn't pinch or bind me, and Outdoor Voices conforms to my body, but it never feels constricting. It's soft, and it comes in pretty colors with support where you want it and comfort where you need it.
Their clothing is engineered for performance and designed with a fabric made for every type of activity.
And each of these fabrics is very cozy and soft, but also maintains its shape. So it works for every body shape. So women, you don't have to be a size 2 to enjoy it. And guys, you don't have to have a 6-pack.
Outdoor Voices offers free shipping and hassle-free returns. And you can shop online at outdoorvoices.com or in select locations across the country.
So for 20% off your first order of $100 or more, visit outdoorvoices.com/TCB and enter TCB. That's outdoorvoices.com/TCB and enter TCB. And let me just throw in my plug here for one of my favorite beauty products, Madison Reed. I really love that Madison Reed is a company that's founded by a woman and a mom, Amy Arrett, and she named this company after her own daughter. The way she's managed to combine the salon quality that we love with the affordability that we need in a hair color to give us beautiful multidimensional hair color at home is really revolutionizing the way that women color their hair. She's bringing us into the future and we're looking good. The uncertainty and so-so quality of store-bought coloring kits motivated me to go out to a professional, and I've spent a lot of money on my hair. But Madison Reed has brought me back home with its super high-quality hair color. When you use Madison Reed, you'll look like you just walked out of a salon. It's convenient, at-home hair color with an ammonia-free salon quality formula. And Madison Reed is made in Italy and delivered to your door for under $25. I really love how Madison Reed has hair models of all ages, colors, and sizes on their website. It's a product that's developed by a real woman, and it's marketed to real women. Find your perfect shade at madison-reed.com. And Madison Reed is continuing to honor our True Crime Brewery listeners with 10% off plus free shipping on your first color kit when you use promo code BREWERY. The website again is madison-reed.com and our promo code is BREWERY.
So now that we've got you well-dressed and talked about hair color options, let's talk about what is really important in life, and that's food. This fall, instead of spending 20 minutes stressing about what to have for dinner, prepare your own delicious, healthy meal with the new quick and easy plan from Sunbasket.
Well, we know that Sunbasket has meal kits that are easy and convenient for anyone, and that's all the way from an expert chef to an amateur. But now getting healthy, delicious meals is even faster and foolproof with their quick and easy meal plan and super speedy recipes. Now you can get pre-measured, easy-to-prep ingredients and organic produce delivered to your door with 10 and 15 minute recipes. Sunbasket has options like paleo, gluten-free, lean and clean, Mediterranean, vegan, and even more.
And you can mix and match from any of the weekly recipes, and you can skip or cancel any time.
So we just tried Spanish orzo with tempeh patatas bravas last Friday night, and it was delicious. As I knew it would be. I mean, we've never been disappointed with a Sunbasket meal, have we?
We have not.
It took just a little over 10 minutes to make, which was awesome, and then it felt like we were eating gourmet takeout. And if you're not familiar with tempeh, it is really delicious. So if you haven't tried it, you should. It's healthy and really delicious.
So go to sunbasket.com/brewery today to learn more and get $35 off your first order. That's sunbasket.com/brewery. to get $35 off your order.
Sunbasket.com/brewery.
By the next morning, the discovery of the mummified body was all over the news.
Big news.
Police were hopeful that the woman would have been reported missing 30 years ago, but there was no record of it. Pages from the address book were being dried out one page at a time. The first page had a readable number written on it. It was the letter A followed by a series of numbers. This turned out to be the alien number that's found on green cards that had been given to immigrants coming to the United States. So this supported the theory that the victim had been an immigrant.
And I'm really in awe of the detective work that was done here.
Well, not just the detective work. It was luck, in a sense, that they were able to get information from the notebook.
That the clues were there, yeah. It wasn't just the notebook, though. It's the plastic pellets. It's the barrel. It's just a fascinating case.
Yeah.
Within days, the U.S. Immigration Services was able to provide them a name and a time that she came into the U.S. The victim was Reina Angelica American, and she was from El Salvador. Reina had an interest in fashion. She could speak and read English, so she'd come to America to realize her dream of becoming a fashion designer. She immigrated to the U.S. back in 1966, and despite being young and on her own, she really seemed to thrive in the United States. She wrote often to her family back in El Salvador, and she even called them on the phone once in a while. So in the winter of 1968, Reina's letters and phone calls had stopped arriving without explanation, and the family knew nothing about her pregnancy or even the relationship that she was in. So for years afterwards, they would just wonder where she went and if she was okay, having no idea that her body had been thrown away, stored away, for 30 years. So this is a true nightmare. This is every family's nightmare.
Well, isn't it? And here your daughter immigrates to the U.S., and you're in fairly close contact with her, despite being in El Salvador. Mm-hmm. But you hear from her, and she visits.
I'm sorry to interrupt you, but communication back in the 60s was tougher than it is now.
Well, it was letter writing.
Yep.
So you go along this way for a couple of years, and then all of a sudden she just vanishes. There's no word from her, no sightings, no visits, no nothing.
And they really don't have any way to find her because they don't know who she consorts with there or anything. They don't speak the language. It's a bad situation for them.
It must have been really, really difficult for her family.
Yeah.
It sounds like they were a fairly close family.
And she was kind of the shining star, you know, the one who was going to immigrate and become a fashion designer, and she really wanted to make more of herself than to just stay in her little town and get married and have a family, which is nothing wrong with that, but that's what most of the girls there were doing.
Right.
So she was kind of a standout.
She was.
A beautiful young woman, too.
And then she just vanishes.
Yeah.
So strange.
So one of the early steps in this investigation was to figure out who had lived in the house where the barrel was found. There had been multiple owners over the years. So one of the first things detectives did was that they went to the town hall to get the property records. There were actually four owners since the house was built, and it was built in 1962. Criminal background checks were done on all the previous owners, and they all came back clean. But while investigating the previous owners, they also focused on the barrel itself. So we have an investigating team. You know, some are looking into the homeowners, into the records. And then we have other ones looking into where did this barrel come from and what about the contents of the barrel, things like that.
That's right. So the barrel turned out to have been manufactured in March of 1963. On the bottom of the barrel were numbers 36355. So 3 for March, 63 for 1963, and 55 because it was a 55-gallon drum. The company that manufactured the barrel had kept records. The company is still in business. That's pretty cool.
Yeah.
And police were able to use those records to determine who that barrel had been sold to.
Right. So that's another lucky thing, I guess, if you're talking about luck, that the business was still open.
Right. And then the company that had purchased the barrel was still in business. So we got the barrel manufacturer still working, and the company that bought it is still in business.
They had used the barrel originally containing a chemical that was used in the dyeing and manufacturing of plastics. So, of course, this made them think of the plastic stem and leaves that they'd found in the barrel with the body, and they saw the connection there immediately. They tested the plastic stem to see if it had been made with the chemical that had been in the barrel. When the rest of Reina's address book had been dried out, most of the pages could be only partially read. But on a few pages, there were some complete phone numbers. The odds that the phone numbers would still be active after 30 years, though, were not great.
Right, I imagine.
So police began making calls, and most of the numbers were out of service, except one, which was a big deal.
Yeah, and the woman who answered that number had known Reina and wanted to talk to police about her. Her name was Kathy Andrade, and she had been a friend of Raina. So for 30 years, Kathy had been living with the pain of never knowing what had happened to her very good friend. Their friendship had begun in the 60s after Raina arrived in New York City to start her career in fashion. The two women worked together in the garment industry, and they became fast friends. They were both from El Salvador, and Kathy told police that Raina was like a sister to her.
Well, Kathy was kind of a mentor to Raina, it seems, because she had been in New York longer, and she spoke better English. Raina confided in Kathy about her married boyfriend, and then about her pregnancy, in I think it was late 1968. She'd been dating a married man who she believed was planning to leave his wife and marry her. And he seemed like he was genuine. He seemed like he was in love with her because he took Raina out on long romantic walks and took her out cruising on his fishing boat and made her a lot of promises. So Raina was happy, thinking, this is the guy. She's going to have her own family in America, start her career in fashion. So she was riding high, feeling pretty good about life. But we don't know how the relationship really was, if there was violence in that relationship.
We don't. We're just getting third-hand info.
But Raina's married boyfriend told her he would take care of her. And he put her up in an apartment in Hoboken, New Jersey, and told her that they would be married and spend the rest of their lives together.
Yeah, just as soon as I get divorced from my wife, we'll be together.
That's right.
The old story.
So Raina was in love with him and believed everything that he told her. Kathy told police that he seemed to be really good to Raina. And he actually took her to the obstetrician every other week for her checkups. So that makes me wonder if maybe he was considering being with her. Maybe he did love her, but then his just wanting to keep his family together and greed for whatever he had financially or materially, maybe that's what overwon him when he decided to kill her. Because it does seem like he planned it, like it wasn't just a sudden rage without any plan. It seemed like he lured her.
Well, maybe he was being extra kind and loving and taking her to the doctor's visits because he was in the process of planning how to get rid of her.
Yeah, but I think if this happened more recently, they would have gone to the doctor. They would have figured out what happened here. Because yeah. He's going to the doctor's office with her and then she disappears. I think it was really... Part of the problem was that she was an immigrant.
Well, the problem is probably that no one reported her missing.
Right. True. Good point. Well, it really did seem like her dreams were coming true, though, at one point. And she seemed happy, Kathy would say, until the spring of 1969. Then Kathy had a very detailed and dramatic story that she shared with police about the night when Raina actually disappeared.
Yeah, Raina had called Kathy. Very upset, because the man had told her he was not going to marry her. So, there go all those plans.
Well, this is devastating if you can put yourself in her shoes. She's 9 months pregnant, immigrant, with no family in the country to help her. Plus, she's in love with him. So then Raina told Kathy that she had done what she called a foolish thing. She had called his wife. And she had told his wife that she was pregnant with his baby. So now she told Kathy that he told her he was going to kill her. And she believed him. She was terrified. So the fact that she believes him, that he's going to kill her, makes me think that he was a violent man. That this wasn't his first violent act against her.
Possibly. I mean, put yourself in his head for a minute.
Okay.
And figure, okay, I've realized I'm not going to be able to divorce my wife and marry this woman. So I've told her. And then what does she do? She turns around and calls my wife and rats me out.
Well, what does he think he's going to do? Just kind of keep this under the table forever?
Yeah.
Okay. All right.
But it's not going to be that way.
Yeah.
So this is scaring for him and angry. Makes him angry.
Mm-hmm. So you don't think that that's any kind of a sign that he was violent before?
I don't think it's necessarily a sign that he was violent before.
But just the fact that he killed her, as we talked about earlier, an indication that he'd been violent before. It usually doesn't come out of nowhere.
Yeah.
So when she called Kathy and told her all this, she was totally terrified. She really believed he was coming to kill her. So Kathy said, no, he's not going to kill you. But Raina insisted that he really would. So Kathy said she'd rush over to Raina's apartment to try and keep her safe. But by the time Kathy got to Raina's apartment and knocked on the door, there was no answer. The door was unlocked, so Kathy let herself in. And when she got in there, it was kind of a strange scene because there was food there that was still warm. So she knew that Raina hadn't been gone for very long. Plus, she just talked to her on the house phone, and there are no cell phones, of course. So Kathy waited at Raina's apartment and was worried about her for several hours. Finally, when she hadn't returned after 4 hours, Kathy went over to the police. She wanted to file a missing persons report, but since it had only been 4 hours, she wasn't able to. Now, I'm not clear at this point if Kathy told the police that her friend's life had been threatened, or if she just said she was missing.
Well, I would think she just said she is missing.
That's kind of strange
to me. Wouldn't they have taken it more seriously if she said that her life had been threatened?
Well, that's why I ask. Are they ignoring her because she's a female immigrant?
I don't think so.
Well, it's clearly too early to file a missing persons report anyway.
Right.
But I just would think if they knew about the threat to kill her, they may have done something. But Kathy left. Maybe she was a little intimidated and didn't really make a big deal out of it, like she might have.
Possibly, but then she went back the next day.
Mm-hmm.
But they still wouldn't take the report because she wasn't a family member.
Well, yeah,
so back then, had to be a member of the family reporting her missing.
But Raina had no family in the United States.
Well.
So this is how this happened, that she just got lost and forgotten in many ways.
So Kathy continued to try to reach Raina for months. And then she finally gave up. She was hoping that Raina had just returned to El Salvador to be with her family. She never stopped worrying and wondering what had happened to Raina. Now, the unfortunate thing is she had no idea who Raina's boyfriend was.
Yeah, which is kind of a difficult thing to believe also, because wasn't he her boss? I think he was.
Was he?
Yeah.
But that doesn't mean that Kathy
would... I'm surprised Raina didn't say he's my boss.
Well, I don't know. Maybe she's being discreet.
I guess so. Detectives who were looking over documents pertaining to the history of the house found a permit for a large extension that had been added to the back of the house by its second owner. The extension was done in 1980, and it was built over the spot where the barrel was found. Police thought that whoever had built the extension was probably responsible for this body in the barrel. So his name was Arthur Eben, and he was the former homeowner who had built this extension. And the interview with Eben made police very suspicious at first because he denied building the extension, and they had paperwork with his name on it. They had documentation of the permit with his name on it. So Eben said that he had actually just brought the extension up to code, and it was first built by the first owner. Then he told police that he had seen the barrel, and he just left it where it was, so he didn't bother with it either.
Uh-huh.
He lived in that house for 12 years and never moved the barrel. He had thought that it was some leftover construction material from when this extension was built and didn't think anything about it. So kind of a similar reaction that Ronald had.
Same story as the present owner.
Yes.
Yeah. So police asked Eben if he knew anything about the first owner, the man he had bought the house from, and his name was Howard Elkins. So Eben remembered that Elkins was married, had a couple kids, and they worked in New York City. He thought that Elkins had been the owner of a plastic flower company. Aha.
So ding, ding, ding.
They immediately made the connection to the plastic-making chemical that had been in the barrel and the plastic stem and leaves found with Raina's body in the barrel.
Right. So Howard Elkins had actually been co-owner of a plastics company, the Melrose Plastic Company, which was a New York maker of decorative artificial plants. This company was sold in 1971. Police planned to speak with Elkins' former partner before speaking with Elkins himself. They wanted to have as much information as possible before interviewing their prime suspect. Mr. Gantman, Elkins' former partner, willingly spoke with the police, and he had a very good memory. After police showed him a picture of the barrel, he identified it as the type of barrel that they would have had at the company. He said it was the type of barrel that held dye for the plastics. The green liquid was actually a chemical they had used to dye the flowers and shrubbery that they were creating at the time. Police also asked if he was aware of Elkins having a girlfriend back in 1968-1969. And Gantman said that Elkins did have a girlfriend, and she worked at the factory. She was petite and very attractive with long black hair. He even remembered the gold on her teeth. So the description he was giving matched Raina exactly.
Yeah, pretty close, huh?
Yeah. It was almost eerie how much he was able to describe her.
Yeah. So this evidence now is beginning to add up, right?
Yeah.
Howard Elkins had owned the house where the barrel was found. He owned a plastic company between 1961 and 1971. And he had a girlfriend who matched the description of Raina Angelica Marroquin.
Well, at this point, Howard Elkins was 70 years old. He was a retired man living in Boca Raton, Florida.
The good life.
So he thinks he's gotten away with it, I imagine. Although, well, that barrel's still there, and he should know that.
Yeah, but it had been how many years?
Over 30.
Right? 68 or so to 99?
Yep.
Yeah, he must have been thinking, okay, I did it. I got away with it.
Maybe, although people are still living in that house, and he didn't get rid of the barrel. So I kind of feel like it was still hanging over his head. But police showed Elkins the same items they had showed his ex-partner, business partner, Mr. Gottman, and they showed him a photo of the barrel. And he said they never used barrels like that in his business, so that was suspicious. He also said the dye that they had tested was not a dye that his company had used either. But he did admit that he had a girlfriend, but he was very vague. He said he had an affair in the 1960s, but he pretended that he didn't remember anything about the woman, not her name, not the color of her hair, not whether she was short or tall or slim. Police knew that he was stonewalling them at that point, because you don't have an affair with someone and not remember anything about them. And the partner remembered her much better than he did.
I just can't remember that woman. I did not have sexual intercourse with that woman.
All right, don't pick on Bill. You know I like Bill.
So Howard Elkins had no explanation for why a barrel with the body of a pregnant woman had been found in his basement. He claimed to have no knowledge of. But by now, police had no doubt he was lying. The detectives said that they wanted a DNA swab from his cheek to compare to the DNA of the fetus. Elkins said no to that and became pretty standoffish. He said he didn't trust them to do the right thing, at one point saying, "Look what they did to O.J." Maybe not the best example.
Yeah, I don't even know where to start with that statement.
I'm going to leave it.
Okay. Because, of course, we don't think anyone did anything to O.J. We think O.J. got away with murder. And I guess Howard thought he should do the same.
Exactly.
So as police were closing in on Howard Elkins at his dining room table, his telephone rang, and it was his wife. He told detectives he did not want his wife to see them there, and she was coming home, so they needed to leave. One of the detectives told him before they left that they were going to get a warrant for his blood and for the DNA swab, and they would have him put away for life. So according to this detective, Elkins was just kind of blank-faced and nodded his head. So I think at this point he knew he was in trouble. And detectives knew that they didn't have enough to arrest him at that point until they had the DNA match. So they went to work on getting the warrant and getting his DNA.
So the next day, guess what? Howard Elkins' wife reported him missing. So the Palm Beach police called the Long Island police to see if they had him in custody. But they didn't. They didn't even have the warrant yet. So the Palm Beach police looked around. They found Elkins in the garage of a neighbor. He had killed himself with a gun in the back seat of a friend's car.
That's not a very good friend.
No. So this was taken as a sign of guilt. People were shocked because he seemed like such a normal guy. Well, until word gets out that he killed his pregnant girlfriend.
Yeah, and he doesn't want to have to deal with that. Everyone's going to know he was a murderer, actually not a normal guy. Because blood tests did confirm that he was the father of Raina's unborn baby. And his motive was that he wanted to stay with his family and he didn't want Raina to have his baby. So police think that Elkins went to Raina's apartment on the day she went missing. They think he somehow lured her to the plastics factory, where there were isolated areas for him to kill her. He was probably in a rage about Raina calling his wife. And he struck Raina on the back of her head with something like a hammer, up to 20 times. So he was definitely in a rage. But he could think about it enough to plan this out and have her go to the plastics factory with him.
Right.
Where you wouldn't have blood spatter in his house or anything. No, so it is a planned out first degree murder.
It is, yep. So he, He killed her, put her body in the barrel, along with her purse and address book, took the barrel home in the back of his car, along with some large bags of plastic pellets. Then at home, he filled it the rest of the way with the black and white plastic pellets and sealed it. So the pellets may have been for increasing the weight of the barrel. We think he may have planned to take the barrel out on his boat and just tip it over into the waters of Long Island Sound. But it was apparently too heavy for him now to manage it, so he rolled it into the crawl space and left it there.
Kind of lazy.
Exactly. And the surprising thing is when they sold the house, he just left the barrel there.
And moved out.
And moved out. So.
And he was just extremely lucky that nobody said anything or looked in it.
Yeah. Nobody bothered looking or trying to find out what the hell's in this barrel.
Yeah, and I know you say that he probably thought he got away with it, but I kind of feel like it had to be a ticking time bomb in the back of his mind. Maybe it was far back, and maybe he didn't think about it all the time, but it had to be in the back of his head that he could be caught.
Oh, sure. Yeah.
Yeah.
But the longer you go without being identified, the more you're thinking, hey, I got away with it.
Right. True. Well, he was kind of lucky when you think about it, because he got 30 years of freedom. He had these 30 more years to live his life, while Raina's loved ones missed her and wondered about her, and of course her life and her baby's life were over. So then he took his life and was never brought to justice, which, you know, irritated the police because they wanted to bring him to trial. It was such an awful crime in so many ways, though. To me, it's really heartbreaking the way he took advantage, using and disposing of this young woman. He even killed his own unborn child for his own gain. Investigators and journalist Oscar Coral found Reyna's family in El Salvador and did notify them. Reyna's mother was still alive. She was 93 years old. Reyna and her unborn son's remains were returned to El Salvador, and they were buried alongside Reyna's mother, who died about a month after finding out about her daughter.
She did learn what had happened.
Yeah.
So.
And some people thought she was kind of hanging on to find out before she died.
That's a good possibility.
Could be. So there are a lot of documentary TV shows about this case, including the ID channels Buried in the Backyard, Forensic Files, and Unsolved Mysteries. There's also a book based on this case by journalist Oscar Coral, but the names and the details of the case are changed for the book, so it's almost more like a novel. But it does give you a lot of information about the investigation and the journalist and how they were involved in solving the crime. So we're going to go on to feedback now, unless you have anything else to add.
Not anymore on this case.
Okay.
Fascinating.
It is.
I mean, lucky, really. Well, the investigators were lucky.
Oh, that they had the stuff.
That they had the evidence. You think of the things that had to go right, that the plastics company was still in business, that they were able to trace the owners. I mean, they got a lot of information that they probably wouldn't have gotten.
Right. Well, just to clarify, the plastics company owned by the murderer was not still open, but the plastic chemical company that had the barrel with the chemical was still in business.
Right.
Okay.
And they were able to say, we sold this barrel to this company.
Absolutely.
So
they were able to trace it quite easily.
And they could trace the house owners.
Mm-hmm.
And they could even find the phone number in this notebook of the lady who knew her, knew Raina best.
And that really put things together, so that was important.
So that was a very serendipitous occurrence that all these things happened that enabled them to identify who it was.
Definitely an unusual crime.
Yes.
Unusual investigation. Don't forget, support for this podcast is brought to you by Hanover Square Press, the publisher of The Boy at the Keyhole by Stephen Giles. A haunting tale of confusion and paranoia, this story is about a boy left alone on his family's English estate with a housekeeper that he suspects has murdered his own mother. Listen to the audiobook today. Just a reminder before we read feedback is that if you'd like to send us some feedback or if you'd like to suggest a crime, you can email us, you can direct message us at Twitter or Instagram or Facebook, or you can leave us a voicemail on our website, tiegrabber.com. If listening to True Crime Brewery is a positive little part of your life, and if you'd enjoy an extra episode once in a while, you can offer your support by joining Team Tiegrabber at tiegrabber.com or by becoming a patron at patreon.com/truecrimebrewery. As a member, you get access to our members-only TCB episodes, and we release a new one every month. These are full-length episodes, so if you like our regular ones, I think you'll enjoy these. And when you join, you're also helping us to pay for the costs of producing and distributing the show. Plus, we're going to send you some great gifts to thank you for your support. Some other ways to help us out are to follow us on Twitter at TigerEverPods, on Instagram, or on Facebook. Also, if you have a few minutes and you can leave us a review on iTunes or wherever you listen to the podcast, we would appreciate that very much. So, Dick, why don't you start with our first email?
Okay. Email from Anonymous. Hi, Dick and Jill. First, thank you so much for your podcast. It is my absolute favorite, and I cannot wait for an episode each week. I'm in the UK, so can't usually download a new episode until Wednesday morning, and I get so irrationally jealous of those that get to do it on a Tuesday, even though in reality, I know we're getting it at the same time.
That's funny.
So my message is a bit more of a personal request, so I won't be upset if you don't read it out. It's just something that has been playing on my mind, and I thought I would finally get it off my chest. I usually agree with you guys and feel like our opinions are quite aligned, which might be why I love listening to you so much, positive reinforcement and all that. But something mentioned a few weeks ago, or even perhaps a few months back, really irked me. This was during one of the feedback sessions where someone had suggested an honor killing case. You guys discussed the possibility of doing this, but then threw out the comment that maybe you could pool these cases together and do an overall honor-killing episode. Now, this to me just sounded so wrong. It would be like someone saying that all domestic violence cases are the same because they share a title. And we all know that that is not the case. Each case is different, each victim is individual, and circumstances are unique. Just because they all sit under the same umbrella does not make them the same. So my personal request to you is this. If you do decide to do an honor-killing case, please, please, please do not do a blanket episode. I appreciate that this idea may have sprung from there being a lack of information on individual cases out there, and the worry that there wouldn't be enough from one case to do a whole episode. If that's true, then maybe we could just hold out until there is. As I said, a personal request, and apologies if I sound petty, but it was a comment that really struck a chord with me, so I thought I'd at least let you know. Thanks again for the amazing work you do, and I look forward to joining you again at the quiet end soon. P.S. You guys are total hashtag couple goals.
All right. Well, thank you, Anonymous. So I get the point here. I can see what she's saying, or he's saying.
Yeah.
Yeah, totally.
I can see that.
Yeah. And you know, we've thought about blanket episodes before, and it's never been a good thing.
It hasn't been.
No.
But like the writer said, maybe we should wait till we have enough information on one individual case, and we can use that as a springboard to talk about the broad picture.
Sure. I think it'd be good to focus on one case, because I do see her point. I mean, we do plenty of domestic violence cases, and we don't group all those together.
No, we don't.
And I think it would just take a little effort to find one that we can dig up enough information on to do an hour worth of talking. So I think it's not as hard as we're thinking it would be. So I'm on board with Anonymous.
Okay.
Okay. So the next email is a comment from Base13 Mary on our most recent episode, Memphis Bridezilla.
Yeah, we have two comments on this episode.
Okay. Well, the first one, she says, the Muslim faith is a big issue. I was married to one, as was my sister. The pressure to convert is not only from the husband, but their family as well. My sister did convert as her husband was a Saudi and she went to live there. What a nightmare. Control over one's wife is all part of the faith. Of course, this poor man didn't deserve this treatment. Now she's referring to the man who was killed in our episode.
The episode.
Ijaz. Yeah.
Yep.
Okay. And then the other comment is from Anthony C. For a Christian or Catholic to convert to Islam is like becoming a devil worshiper. The two religions are diabolically opposed to each other. One is about peace, love, faith, and the other is about submission, oppression, and domination. Whoa. So I'm thinking Anthony's a Christian who's not saying very good things about Islam.
Well, and I just looked up some basic tenets of Islam versus Christianity, and there's an awful lot of similarities too.
Okay.
So I don't ascribe to his statement that one religion is about peace, love, faith, and the other is about submission, oppression, and domination.
Well, I am far from an expert, but I'm thinking that maybe this nightmare of controlling women and oppression. Maybe that's the radical Islam and not all Muslims.
Yeah, that could be.
I don't know. I'm just throwing that out there because I really don't like to criticize any one religion, especially with the limited knowledge that I have. But why don't you go ahead and tell us the similarities between these two religions, basically.
So Christians believe that God is three gods merged into one God, mm-hmm. Father, Son, Holy Ghost, which Muslims also believe. They have Allah, Holy Spirit, and a Jesus figure. So that's a similarity. They both believe in Mary, Virgin Mary.
Hmm.
The Bible in Christian religion is accepted as 100% faultless. The Muslims have varying beliefs, but similar to the Bible, maybe not accepted as 100%. They have prophets. Both religions have prophets. They have a lot of other similarities.
So I guess the main thing is, what's the problem with converting? Is it just the way that women are treated? Is that basically it?
Well, that's my question.
Yeah. If religion was the issue with Bonnie and Ejaz in our Memphis case, what was it exactly that Bonnie had against it? Because I think what we were saying, which might have irritated some people, is that we were saying it really wasn't the religion. They must have had differences other than that.
Right. And I think we said that to us, it wouldn't matter if you really loved the person.
But that's easy to say if you're not really a devout religious person.
Sure.
Although Bonnie didn't seem devout, but...
And I would think that a big issue would be control of the husband over the wife.
I don't know.
As to why she wouldn't convert. And Anthony says it's all about submission, oppression, and domination. I'm not sure about that. But I think that's the general idea, is that if you're a female and you convert to Islam, you're going to be under the thumb of your husband.
I wonder how true that is. Well, I don't really feel like either of us is in a position to make a judgment on that, really.
No.
So I'll just put people's comments out there and take them for what they are. But I definitely don't want to insult one religion and pick another one over it. I wouldn't do that.
No, we didn't do that.
Okay.
So I have a comment from Jackie A. And after I read it, I'm going to be happy to tell Jackie that I think we found what she was looking for.
Okay.
So Jackie's comment is, I think I heard from you on another video that you read Ann Rule. For years, at least 15, I have wondered about one of the shorter stories at the end of one of her books. I don't remember which book. Possibly it's The End of the Dream. But the story in the book was about a woman in Washington State that worked for the power company. She was working alone in a secluded area on one of those great big green boxes that are in fenced-in enclosures. She didn't return home, so her boyfriend was looking for her in the area he thought she was working. He found her work van, but not her. Now, I know he was cleared. He was trying to find her for a long time. This story has always stuck with me. Her boyfriend was so heartbroken. Jackie A. says, I have tried Googling the story, but I've had no luck because I don't remember what the story was called or the woman's name. I just want to know if they ever found her dead or alive. Does this ring any bells for you or for anyone reading this? I did some research and didn't come up with anything, and I was going to be reading Jackie's comment to enlist help from people. And then my brilliant wife found her.
I stumbled upon it.
At least we think this is what Jackie's looking
for. This sounds like it was it, yeah.
So why don't you tell us about it, Jill?
All right, well, here's what I've got. I've got Julie Weflin worked as an operator for the Bonneville Power Administration in Spokane, Washington. She parked her minivan in the gravel lot along Four Mound Road and logged into the Spring Hill substation near Riverside State Park at 2 p.m. on the day she disappeared. BPA workers have stated that she probably finished work and returned to the minivan around 3:45 p.m. Julie was last seen heading toward a substation at Four Mound and Cooley Height Road. Her hard hat toolbox, a water bottle, and a pair of sunglasses were located on the ground beside her truck, and the driver's side door and back hatch were found open. Her purse was discovered in the rig where she had worked. A reward of $25,000 was issued for any information leading to the arrest and conviction of the person or persons involved in Julie Weflin's disappearance. Since she disappeared, the BPA and local law enforcement officials have received plenty of information, but nothing has ever helped finding her, so she's still missing. Her husband, Mike, who had really pushed to keep attention on the case, eventually accepted that Julie wasn't going to return, and he eventually remarried and became a father. Investigators on the case have come and gone. Some retired, others have moved to different jobs. They have a few leads in the case, and they now call it a homicide, but there's no body, no murder weapon, and no known motive. Julie was actually one of three regional women who went missing during an 18-month time span back in the mid-1980s, and whose disappearances are all unsolved. Teacher Debbie Swanson, 31, was last seen on March 29, 1986. Sally Ann Stone, a 21-year-old exotic dancer, vanished on May 16th that year. And Julie went missing northwest of Spokane on September 16th, 1987. It was Julie who received national attention, and this was mostly thanks to her husband's efforts. As an operator for the BPA, Julie's duties included energizing and de-energizing power equipment, reading meters, and keeping transformers powered up. On the day she disappeared, she was working with Owen Berrio, a former BPA electrician who's retired now. Julie disappeared around 3:30, and her hard hat and toolbox, water bottle, sunglasses were all found. The gravel around the car showed signs of a struggle, including what appeared to be drag marks. A fresh tire pattern not belonging to Julie's vehicle was also found near the substation. Her van was parked in the lot, and there were fairly large pieces of rock that were stirred up. Mike Weflin, her husband, was in Ritzville for his house painting job at the time, and he later told crime novelist Ann Rule that he returned to his motel room to find a note on the door. "Call BPA, your wife has been kidnapped."
Huh.
I'm thinking this must be the case, right?
Yeah, it sure sounds like what our writer was asking about.
Mm-hmm. There were about 80 billboards along major roads in Oregon, Washington, Montana, and Idaho that were mostly donated that featured Julie's face. And her story was also featured on Good Morning America, and there was an article in Good Housekeeping in February 1989. Ann Rule, who actually wrote about 1,400 criminal cases over the years, came to Washington when she heard about the case, and she included a chapter about Julie in her 2004 book, Kiss Me, Kill Me. So, you have to let me know if that's the one you're talking about, Jackie, but it sure sounds like it.
It does, doesn't it?
Mm-hmm. So, I don't own that book, but maybe I'll look into that.
Let's check it out.
Okay.
Okay, one more. Linda B. Hi, love your podcast. I have a show suggestion. A podcast on this has never been done, as far as I know. The dude's name is Jorge Torres, who was a Marine stationed at Henderson Hall in Virginia with my daughter. My daughter spent many months with him, and they came to our home many times. I can't believe a murderer stayed in my home and went to church with me.
Creepy.
Anyway, he killed a sailor named Amanda Snell and stuffed her in a wall locker.
Mm.
He had also killed two kids in Chicago, and their father had gone to prison for this.
For the murder?
For the murder.
Wow.
So Google him and let me know if I can help. I'd love to see you all cover this.
Okay, so did you Google it?
I did. So what I found is that Jorge Torres had been convicted and was sentenced to death for the murder of U.S. Navy sailor Amanda Snell. Now, he refused to defend himself, and his defense team believe this indicates he wants the death penalty. He's also suspected of murdering Laura Hobbs, 8 years old, and her friend Crystal Tobias, 9 years old, in 2005 in Illinois, when Torres was only 16 years old.
So were these sex crimes? Is this a pedophile or?
These were sex crimes.
Okay.
DNA evidence and a recorded confession to another inmate strongly links him to the brutal raping and stabbing of these two kids.
Awful.
Jerry Hobbs, the father of Laura, was wrongly convicted of their murders in 2005, and he was released from prison in 2010 and received a payout of $8 million for his wrongful conviction.
Yeah, but is there any amount of money that can make up for years of people thinking you killed two little girls, one of them your daughter?
No.
That's just horrendous. I can't imagine the hell that that guy went through.
Well, and they had arrested him for the murder of Amanda Snell when he had been brought in and actually had been, I think, convicted of rape and beating of a woman. So he was already in the system, and then they got him for murdering the Navy sailor. Now, he hasn't been brought to trial for the little kids' deaths yet, or if he is, but interesting sounding case.
That is. I'd like to look into that more if you'd like to.
Let's do it.
Okay.
All right.
Yeah, there's this creepy little thing here where it said that he reportedly laughed when he was told that the little girl's dad had been found guilty of the murder.
Yeah.
So that sounds like true evil.
Well, he didn't. He's thinking, got some sucker to take the fall for me.
Right. So no conscience there.
Nope.
No. Well, that's some good feedback. No voicemails this week, but we'll have some next week, I'm sure.
If we don't, we will. We'll make some up.
If we don't, I'll call.
Okay. We'll take turns calling.
Okay.
All right.
Well, thanks for listening, everyone. And I just wanted to say one more time that our new music is by Tristan Capel. And if you want to find out more about Tristan or hear more of his music, he has a website, tristancapel.com. So take a look at it. And we will see you next time at The Quiet End.
We got a couple seats saved for you.
Bye-bye.
Bye.